This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm here with Robert Joseph, wine writer and wine tasting expert, and probably the man that's inspired a lot of people in the trade now. How are you, Robert?
I'm fine, thank you. I don't know about inspired, but I think that wine, the good thing about wine is that it's like music, it's like anything else. Somebody has to turn you onto it. Somebody got you to eat your first oyster. Somebody played you Mozart for the first time, or took you to a cricket match, or did whatever. And if you've never got into cricket, it's probably because somebody didn't do that.
Yeah.
And that's what wine to me is about. And every now and then I meet people who say, oh, I've got this great bottle of 1961 Chateau, whatever, and I don't know who to open it for. And my answer is actually open it for somebody who's never tasted anything like that before, because it's going to be, if it's any good, it's going to be a life-changing, in a small way, life-changing event. And to me, that's what we should all do. Any of us who've discovered anything in life, we should pass that on.
Okay. The reason I said that about inspiring, because you talk to a few people and they sort of say, because you've been around the traps for quite a while.
I started very, very young.
Yeah. So a bit of grey on the roof. But nothing too serious. And quite a few people say, you know, it was a lecture by Robert or something like that that turned them on. You know, I've got a guy working for me and he's like, yeah, Robert's a great guy. So I'm really pleased to have you on the show.
I think the wine, well, thank you. But I think I have to say the wine business is, certainly in Britain, a lot of the people that you've come across here, there are people like Oz Clark and Tim Atkin and others who have been, I think generally in Britain, we as a group are generous with our time. I think there's not a lot of sniping between the wine writers, and I think most of us have actually, and Jancis Robinson I know has helped people along and so on, and I think that's really what we should do. And whether it's just in terms of giving a good lecture that somebody that works, or maybe answering a call from somebody when they've got something that they want to find out about. I mean, that means I'm going to get thousands of calls tomorrow. But
exactly.
Yeah, I think that, as I said, I think it's a question of passing the baton in some way or other. So, you know, it's very nice for people to say that about me, but I'm sure that that's also true of a lot of other people.
What are you doing at the moment, Robert?
Lots of different stuff, which is fun. I'm no longer a consumer wine writer, which is what I was until probably about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that probably for more than 20 years. I felt I'd sort of been there and done that. And I also wanted, because I've spent a lot of time talking to wine makers about what I thought they should do, which is a lot of wine writers do as they're visiting or to their mates. And I decided it was time that maybe I should find out whether my theories made sense. So for the last 2 years, I've now been involved in making wine or blending wine in southern France and elsewhere. I'm working with a winemaker called Hugh Ryman and a brilliant designer, label designer called Kevin Shaw, who I think many people, even if they're not into wine, might have come across in the shape of the label for Hendrix Gin and for Clos de Siete wine from that's Michel Roland's wine from Argentina, a number of other wines. And you might think, well, why is the label designer important? You know, surely you just give somebody a few pounds and just get the label. As far as I'm concerned, wine today it's a package of all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And you've got to get the bottle into somebody's hands. And I don't want to spend lots of money advertising it or promoting it to people. What I want to do is get the wine to look right, feel right, be the right price. And then, after the first bottle, I reckon they're only ever going to buy the second bottle because they like the first one.
So
what's in the bottle has got to taste right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm trying to... one of the things is try and make a Bordeaux that you can buy for £5 or £6 that actually tastes good. And that's actually a very tough... It's what the Australians would call a big ask.
Why is that?
Because in some years you can do it. In 2005 it was easy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
2006 it was tougher. 2007 it was tougher still. So what we came up with the idea was to do a non-vintage Bordeaux and blend between different parts of the region.
Okay.
And it's a tough one. But I'm come up with a range of organic wines from different countries. And that's also interesting because whilst a lot of people think they like the idea, they like the idea of drinking organic wine, there's also a lot of people out there who've had bad experiences with organic wine because there are some pretty duff organic wines out there, most of them being fully organic. In other words, the people who make the wine have cut down on the use of sulfur dioxide in the actual winemaking process, which means the wines tend to be pretty unreliable. Yeah. And what I'm interested in is wines made from organically grown grapes.
It's a subtle distinction
on the label, but I think it makes a huge difference, because there is no reason why that wine should ever be less reliable or less good. But reliability, I hate to say this, but I used to drive English sports cars. I used to drive MGs and things like that. And I was actually, for a brief while, in a peculiar way, I was very religious. I prayed daily on my way to the car, you know, please start. Whatever God
I had a van
of MGs,
like that when I was a
just
student.
Please. And I always left home late. And I always, and then one day I discovered a new God, and it was called the Golf GTI. And, you know, I didn't have to just put the key in, turned in, it worked. And I don't know why wine has to have that unreliability factor. It's one of the reasons why, you know, you're a Kiwi, so you understand about screw caps. Anybody tells me that corks are better. They're not. Some corks are brilliant. Lots of corks aren't, and you never know which is going to be a good one. So as far as I'm concerned, screw caps are good technology in 2007. I'm pretty sure that in 2009 or 2012, we'll have other things that are better.
Yeah,
but at the moment, I'd go for screw caps. Having said that, my wines at the moment, I've got some wines with screw caps, some with synthetic corks. At the moment, I've actually got natural corks in my organic wines, because people who buy organic wines seem to want natural corks.
Yeah.
I hate using them.
Oh, really? Mm. Okay. I'm not a big fan of natural cork, but I understand some of the variability associated with it. Okay. What about, you've done a wine travel book?
Did a travel book. It's called The Wine Travel Guide to the World, and it's basically a slightly odd concept, because the initial idea was let's do a wine that told you where to go and visit in Bordeaux and Barossa Valley
and so on.
You mean
there's a chateau open in Bordeaux you can go and visit?
Well, I was going to come back to that. Bordeaux has actually got big signs up saying go away, although less politely than that. One of my well-known chateau in Saint-Estèphe, Chateau Coste-Essonnel, last time I looked, had a sign up saying, if you'd like to visit, send a fax, which is really useful if you've driven up outside the door, because most of us, I don't know, maybe the BlackBerry today, the latest version of BlackBerry or the iPhone lets you fax, but most of us, actually on our mobile phones, aren't necessarily equipped to send a fax from the front door of the chateau.
Do you think that's because they're just not aware of that, or do you think they just don't want you
they
to come
They don't want
visit.
You to be there, really. They basically, unfortunately, the tradition, particularly in Bordeaux, is you're very welcome to come and see us if you already know about our wines, if you want to buy some, if you speak French, et cetera, et cetera. That's changing. It's changing slowly. But the point about the book was that I didn't just want to do that. What I wanted to do was to give to the whole world. So it tells you about places to visit in China, in India, in just about every country, in Ecuador, all sorts of places, as well as inevitably the Yarra Valley, Barossa Valley, Marlborough, Otago, and so on. So it's, and it also gives you restaurants and wine bars. And
so if you go to the region, you can try some pretty good wines from there, as well as restaurants.
If you're in Moscow, where would you get a good bottle of wine?
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a winery in Russia as well. Chateau Vostok.
I'm sure there's more than one wine.
There's only one of any quality I've found so far, but I'm sure there are others.
I suppose they used to get all their wine from Georgia.
They used to. They don't now. not a lot, no.
Okay. So did you have to do a lot of travelling for that?
I did, but in fact what I was doing also, I travel a huge amount. I've just recently come back from Australia and America and China. And I'm off to India and Vietnam, and then there's bits of Europe, and this year I've been to New Zealand and other places. So a lot of that, but also I'm sort of drawing on other experiences in the past and all the people that I've met along the way. So the problem about any guidebook, particularly wine books, I used to do something called the Good Wine Guide every year. The trouble is that the day the book comes out from the printer, it's out of date by definition. So I think we're going to do a lot better when things go online.
Mm.
But actually, there's still something rather nice about a book. It's funny if I say I'm not into corks. Books are old technology, like corks are old technology. But actually, physically handling a book,
it's quite nice.
Has a quality to it.
Interesting about China. So you've been to China recently.
Yeah.
You know, we've been tasting a wee bit of Chinese wine. Not brilliant, but not bad at the same time. Is there anything really outstanding in China?
Not outstanding yet. Grace Vineyards is good. The Shangyu one that you probably tasted recently is probably not bad. But just watch that space. My money is on us getting some really good Chinese wine coming through in the next 2 or 3 years as the fingernails are getting old, but also technology is getting better. The great thing, what I love about China, is the Chinese, they know what they don't know. It sounds a bit like Donald Rumsfeld, I know, but they actually are very clear on how much they've got to learn.
Yeah.
The Japanese tend not to want to admit that they need to learn, in my experience, and the Californians, when I first went there, actually didn't imagine there was anything to learn. And to my mind, the humility of the Chinese is going to carry them along a long way, very fast.
We did some news articles a wee while ago about the Canadians going into China to teach them how to make ice wine.
I was there. I know the guy whose winery they bought, a guy called Joseph Zimmerman, who's a nice German immigrant to Canada, and he sold his business for, I think, $3 or $4 million, and they have today got more acreage of ice wine vineyards in China than there are in Canada.
See, I haven't tried any. Are they any good?
They're only really beginning to make it now. But, you know, the thing is, the Chinese are already growing truffles, and they're making high-quality truffles, you know, which is one of the things you thought was impossible.
Oh, no, they're making truffles in New Zealand, so...
Yeah, the cheaper in China. You see, that's the interesting thing. Yeah. And, you know, they will get everything else they're doing. They're looking at foie gras, all the luxury things in the world. They're trying to see how they can do it. And ice wine is one they can do. Where I was up there, it goes down to -25 in winter. So it's a place you wouldn't do much else.
What are they using? Riesling? Or
No. They're learning from there. They're learning from the Canadians. They use Vidal. Okay. Which, I mean, I as far as I'm concerned, if I never had to drink another Vidal ice wine in my life, I wouldn't mind. Not that I dislike it, but it's just not one of the great wines. It tends to get an extraordinarily easy ride in wine competitions, including ones I've chaired, and from wine writers, because it's seductive, sweet stuff.
Yeah.
But I really don't think it's one of the world's great wines. But it's incredibly profitable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My advice is don't actually drink it. Just buy the companies that make it or buy shares in them. Then you could afford to drink some really good Riesling ice wine from Germany, but actually I still wouldn't drink ice wine. I'd actually go for a really good Trockenbier and Eisleser or a good late harvest wine for somewhere else. Yeah, okay.
What other, like, China obviously is a bit of an unusual one for a lot of people. What other things did you cover in your book that was a wee bit...
Oh, well, I mean, the floating vineyards of Thailand, which are quite fun, where they actually pick the grapes from boats. Lovely photographs of very beautiful Thai girls in traditional costume picking the grapes. I don't know this really happens, but it looks good in the photographs. But they literally are at sea level. And you know, the wines aren't great, but they're a lot better than many a wine that you've had out of Europe. And that whole idea of new latitude wines, the idea of wines made between the tropics, which shouldn't be made, according to what we all learned about at school.
We called 30-50 because...
Doesn't now. There's a fascinating area on the top of Brazil, which is about 9 degrees south.
What's
and it's called São Francisco Valley, or Petrolinas is the other name for it. Rio Sol is the one that Waitrose has got now for $4.99.
Yeah, it's good.
It's not a great £4.99 wine, but it's perfectly decent. It's actually the profitability of a wine where they're actually making 2 to 3 harvests a year with Brazilian wages is not bad. So again, invest in that. I don't say invest in the wine, but invest in the companies that make.
Yeah,
I don't think you can. I think you can buy shares in them, but if you could, they're the ones to have.
And India's having a crack at that as
I've not yet had a multi-vintage or sort of many vintages per year wine from India that's interesting. Two, I've just been there and I'm doing an Indian... it's about a year ago and I'm going back there in a few weeks. I'm doing an Indian wine challenge, the first of those. There are about 60 wineries in India. There are only three I've come across so far that are making... truly internationally competitive wines.
Who are they?
Sula, Grover, and Renaissance. Having said that, I'm looking forward to finding there's at least 5 that I knew that I haven't tasted wines from, and I haven't tasted all the others.
Yeah.
But I've done a certain amount of work trying to find out, and it will be interesting. I think so far India, there's a weird thing that in the West, and that would include places like France and so on, a lot of people say, India or China, and some of them seem to want India to be the next wine market. And I suspect there's something slightly racist in that, by which I mean this is controversial stuff, but I think we like India because they speak English and they play cricket. Not that we play with the French, but at least they speak English.
Yeah.
China is more complicated and inscrutable, etc. The point to be made, there's one brutal fact. that as of today, there are 1.3 billion people in each of these countries. In India, they are currently drinking a teaspoonful of wine each, which is a lot of teaspoons.
Yep.
And in China, they're drinking a glass of wine each, which is a lot of glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
And the consumption is going up in both these places by about 40%.
Okay, so one's got a stronger base.
So basically, unless the Chinese stop fast, India ain't never going to catch them.
Yeah,
it will happen. You know, I'm watching both with great interest, but it's going to. I think at the moment China is way ahead, and one of the things to be taken into account in India is there's a huge anti-alcohol lobby.
Yeah, yeah.
Which in China,
they're the big Chinese spirits drinkers.
There's less whiskey in India, by the way, but the Chinese government, which is not entirely uninvolved in what goes on in daily life in China, have decided in their wisdom, and I would say it's wisdom, that wine has a particular quality that actually cider is would share with it, which is that it is, if you assume that people are going to want to drink alcohol, which is a fair assumption, it is better that they drink alcohol made from something that you cannot eat. In other words, you cannot live on, like staple. So rice wine is bad. Beer is bad. Whiskey is bad.
Why do they have that view?
Because they've got to feed 1.3 billion people.
Yeah, okay.
So if you actually make your alcohol from grapes, you're not actually using up rice or wheat or cereals or whatever from which you can make bread.
And the land use is probably
so
different
exactly.
As well.
So grapes, you know, it's actually a very useful thing. So cider would be the only other option. They've chosen to go for wine. And they see that as being a very easy way to keep their people happy. Alcoholically happy, if you like, whilst being able to grow other things for food.
I was talking to Matt Skinner a wee bit earlier today. He was saying that he heard that China is now the biggest importer of bulk wine out of Australia.
It was. Two things have happened. I hate to argue with Matt Skinner because he's currently beating me in the competition we're running here, but in this instance, I think he's using last year's statistics, which are probably the current ones, but two things have happened. One is that Australia's bulk wine has dried up quite literally because there's no water. So Australia is not the place to get bulk wine anymore. You can get bulk wine. We'll come back to that in a second. And China's own production is growing by the year. So today China doesn't need the bulk wine and Australia can't produce it. More to the point, any Australian listeners to the podcast here, here is my prediction that in 2008, when you buy cask wine, which you might well do, have a look at the country of origin of the cask wine you get from the big companies, the big brands of cask wine you're currently buying, and I will lay money that you'll be seeing wine of Chile and wine of Argentina there, because I know for a fact that the big Australian wine companies have bought a lot of bulk Argentine and Chilean wine to put into the casks so they can go on exporting the Australian wine overseas.
Foster's has done a big push. Peter Lindemann.
They've all done it, and I don't think Lehman has, but Lindemann certainly, I think, would have done. And by the same token, this is not that new, because you as a Kiwi might remember that when New Zealand was short of wine, there was a lot of Chilean Sauvignon Blanc that went into casks in New Zealand. And that happened, there was a winery called CJ Pask, which was first people to do it. They got, Kate Radburn, the winemaker there, got roasted by the press for selling Chilean wine. She didn't pretend it was anything other than Chilean wine. But within 2 years of her doing that, it was being done by a lot of big companies.
I haven't seen
it. It was happening. You look back at it, a lot of Chilean wine, probably about 5 years ago. We went through the short harvest years.
Yeah, yeah.
So around the world, and at the moment, if you go and buy, I was in California, you look at Californian labels, BV, Beaulieu, as it's pronounced in America, is a well-known, one of the classic old Zinni. California brands. BV Coastal, which sounds Californian, comes from France at the moment.
No way.
There's another winery called Mark West.
It's marketed as a Californian wine.
No, it's marketed in the same way as an Australian friend of mine's BMW that was made in South Carolina, or my Bosch dishwasher, which I think was made in Slovenia. Basically, or my Armani suit, which I don't happen to have, but if I had an Armani suit, that would almost certainly these days be made in China. But say if not Armani, he said, thinking about the lawyers, there are a lot of Italian and French clothes that are made in China.
Oh, yeah.
Under Italian law, unless I'm pretty sure on this, I think that all you're required to do is to sew the buttons, or indeed possibly the Made in Italy label, in Italy, and that is sufficient effort within Italy for you to be able to put Made in Italy.
I'll have a look there, because I've got a bit of that BV Coastal at home, and I've...
Yeah, well, it depends when you which vintage it is.
Yeah, so it's quite a couple of years old.
You may find, if you bought it, and also, did you buy it over here or over there?
Over here.
If you bought it over here, it'll be Californian.
Okay, Robert, I think we'll wrap it up there. All right, well, cheers very much, Robert.
Thank you very much, Chris, and look forward to doing this again.